It's either I put myself down for my own talent, which is I don't think is right because I know I'm talented. I know I'm just as good, if not more. Or like I just, yeah, admit that it's just the system that's like not accommodating to me.
We would like to acknowledge that we are on stolen Yuggera and Turrbal lands, and as settlers of colour, we reflect upon the damaging legacy of colonisation. Always was, always will be.
My name is Satika. Well, that's my stage name, but I prefer people to call me Tika. That's what my family and friends call me, so I feel like I feel a lot closer and a lot more intimate with people if they call me Tika, because okay. Satika is just way too like long, hard to pronounce. I am a musician, so a singer-songwriter first and foremost, and I'm a producer as well. I DJ a little bit. I'm trying to get into it a lot more. And then I dabble in some instruments as well. That's pretty much it.
As migrants, we all have a wonderful array of different stories that lead us here. Yours is perhaps a bit unusual. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So I came here when I was 19. I did my bachelor study at UQ. Yeah. So that was in information technology. Uh-huh. So it was just like a year of study. Basically, I was just finishing the study that I was already doing in Indonesia. Uh-huh. It was like an international program type thing. Mm-hmm. And then after that, I had the opportunity to do my master's degree. So I did my master's in computer science. And then I graduated. And then I actually got deported. So there was a lot that happened in between. So my student visa expired while I was still doing my studies.
Right.
Because I think I failed one course. Yeah. And I couldn't really like apply for another student visa because, you know, I didn't have enough unit to do.
Okay.
So I had to go back because it was just a certification and I can technically do it in Indonesia. So that's what I did. I went back and finished that certification course. And then I came back on a visitor visa because it was just for graduation. And then, I mean, the plan was to apply for a temporary working visa because obviously I graduated and I wanted to find a job here.
Yeah.
And then my visitor visa was expiring. That was after the graduation. And then I tried to extend, but there was like some bureaucracy issue. It was my bad. Like I was dumb. I was a dumb bitch.
You're 19, right?
Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, at that time I was already in Indonesia and Australia for maybe 2.5 years because I did my bachelor and my master's.
Yeah.
But so I was like new country, 21, 22.
New country, migrated alone.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, exactly. Like you make mistakes and it was such a simple mistake that could have been avoided, but I think it just like rolled into like a huge thing. So I couldn't, my visa extension was refused because I filled out the form incorrectly, something like that.
Right.
And then I called the immigration and was like, hey, I made this mistake, but technically I'm eligible to apply for this temporary working visa because I graduated and I've studied here and all that stuff. I paid tuition, whatever.
Yeah.
And they were like, yeah, sure. Like you can, yeah, go ahead and apply. But so I did apply, but because apparently my previous onboard visa application was rejected, any further visa application that you apply for will be deemed invalid.
Mm.
So I was waiting for that visa to go through for the temporary working visa to go through.
Yeah.
And then the bridging visa they gave me when I applied was expired, when it expired.
Yeah.
And then after that, they said, oh, your visa application is invalid. And so my visa application was rejected. And at the same time, I overstayed my bridging visa at the time. And so it was just, it was so messy. I went to the immigration and they were like, yeah, actually, we are deporting you. You need to leave in a month's time, and then you're not allowed to apply for any temporary visa for 3 years. So you're banned from...
You get blacklisted.
Yeah, so Whoa. You're banned from applying for a temporary visa. Yeah. So that was rock bottom for me, I think. Like, that was really, just really sad. It went, like, it sent me down a black hole.
Yeah.
Yeah, because obviously, like, my partner at the time was, you know, living in Brisbane, and then also all my friends and my, like, basically I've made a home here in Australia.
Yeah.
And I had to go back to Indonesia and start over. And yeah, I was really depressed. And I think I just started doing music things as well, like for my own. Yeah, because, like, I was, before that, I was obviously busking. I was, like, doing cover gigs and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And then around this time, I finally started to, like, record my own songs and stuff like that. And then I had to sort of put that all on hold. And, yeah, I had to pack up everything and go back to Indonesia. And then, but then, luckily, so we met with, like, a immigration lawyer.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
They were like, we found a loophole. So you can technically apply for permanent residency because they only ban you for temporary working visas, right?
Okay.
Yeah, any temporary visas, but you can apply for permanent residency.
All right. Yeah.
Yeah. But it was so expensive. Mm. Yeah. And so my partner at the time, luckily, was willing to sponsor me. So that's what we did. Okay. We did a partner visa situation.
Yeah.
I got all this, like, statutory declarations and, you know, just evidence and from, like, friends and family, that sort of thing, just to, like, basically approve that our relationship is real. I'm, like, kind of nervous that this is going to end up in, like, immigration, like... Home Affairs, like, agency, and they're like, actually, you're not even together anymore. Like, what?
But I mean, that's the nature of life, right? Like,
yeah.
Like, people, even if someone's getting married to someone,
yeah,
and has a visa,
yeah.
What are the, you know, there's certain high failure rates of marriage that everyone is aware of.
Yeah.
So that's the case for any relationship, anyway, right?
Yeah,
so.
Exactly. And I'm like, I'm paying tax now. Like, it's,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Just so let me.
What are the, like, so. I can't remember the precise location, but I kind of traveled overland through Indonesia on my way back to Sri Lanka, Indonesia, Malaysia, Thailand. And there was, because I was traveling overland, there were certain parts where I was not that in control of the duration. And I was told a bus leaving Jakarta for, I think, going up northwest through Java to a ferry port across to Malaysia. Does that sound geographically right?
Yeah.
Was told that that would be, I don't know, like a 20-hour odd bus ride. It ended up being 60 hours.
Wow.
And then I had, like, overstayed by a couple of days. And,
oh, no.
And being in Indonesia as a tourist, it's an overstay and it's a fine and it's not that...
No.
It's a bit of stress, but it's not that big a deal.
Yeah.
But kind of messing with Australian immigration is a different level.
So they're so strict here.
Getting deported, like, what is the, like, do you have to buy your own flight? Like, what are the nuts and, like, you need to leave or we kick you out? Like, how does it functionally work?
So they gave you a bridging visa, which means you have to vacate in that, like, in one, like, a month's time.
Yeah.
And I actually can't remember what I have to do. Yeah, I don't know if I had to, but, like, I definitely had to purchase my own ticket, obviously.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was like, cause it was not like
let yourself out.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like, it's not like I, you know, I was a threat to,
yeah,
you know, to
being
the country.
Escorted on
or like breaking some sort of rules. It was just, yeah. So yeah, that's what I did.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And then let's go back a bit to what made you interested in what put Brisbane, Mianjin and Australia on the map for you? Like, what made you interested in being here?
I mean, I like that it's quieter than the other cities.
Yeah. But like when, before you moved here, like not knowing, I presume you didn't know a whole lot about it. Like what was the attraction
then?
Not at
all. Well, it's just because like we had relations like with the university that I was at.
Yeah.
So they have like relations with UQ.
Yeah.
And that's sort of, yeah, you get two options. You can finish your study in UQ or RMIT.
Right.
And at the time, a lot of my classmates are going to UQ.
Yeah.
So I was like, I mean, I'll just do what everyone else is doing.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
But I love it here. When I first got here, I was like, it's so quiet. It's like, it's pretty much just like students or like, you know, retirees. Because
what were you used to before? Like, where were you living? Where did you grow up?
I was in Java. Mm-hmm. So that's where I grew up is a very small town.
Mm.
It's called Kendari in Sulawesi. Uh-huh. I keep telling people it's the island that looks like K on the map.
Yeah, I'm picturing that straight away. Is it in the tourist lens, is it famous for like diving and that sort of?
It does a little bit,
yeah,
but definitely not as, like there's other more famous island to do all that stuff.
But that's probably a good thing for that area. Like it's not too much on the
tourism
sphere.
Absolutely. Mm. Because I brought my partner at the time back like a while ago for my brother's wedding.
Yeah.
And he was a celebrity. It was crazy because he's obviously like white Australian.
Yeah.
Yeah. Everyone was like, everyone at the wedding, like most of my relatives, like there were a line to get photos with him more than like the line to get photos with my brother. That was just, it was really funny.
Yeah. We love the white worship in, in non-Western
countries. Oh my God.
Don't we?
Yeah, everywhere I go.
Like I'm told even in South Asian cultures and religious communities that it's considered good luck to have a white person at a wedding. Like does get to that level in your experience? Okay.
No, but I mean like it did affect me in different ways, I think, because Indonesia was colonized by the Dutch.
Mm.
And
we had them as well.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. Yeah, and so I feel like definitely like beauty standards wise and stuff like that. Definitely it's affected.
Yeah.
Growing up, my mom would just like, she does this like ritual in the morning where she would like pinch my nose and trying to get it to like, you know, go up and like say all this like, you know, mantra or whatever prayer.
Wow.
Yeah. So I feel like I don't know if this is scientifically right, but like I feel like it causes a bit of like sinusitis now. And like growing up, like I have trouble breathing and stuff.
Oh,
like that.
Wow!
So it's just stuff like that, and like you know, beauty products.
Yeah.
Like it's all about brightening and whitening.
Yeah,
and
the whitening creams are pretty dominant in that part of the world too.
Yeah. But yeah, stuff like that, and like people make fun of you if you're tanner than everyone, because like you know it means like you're out, you're poor, you're out like playing in the sun all day.
Oh right, you're not privileged to live indoors in the AC all the time, be isolated from the natural environment.
I assume it's just it's just a lot of like that fucked upness that's like so normalized. Which is sad.
Yeah, the post-colonial colorism legacy is so prevalent in so many parts of the world. It's wild.
Yeah, I mean, like, I can also admit that I have some sort of, like, internal, racism.
Internalized
and, like,
racism.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
That I'm still working on.
100%.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's a lifelong process of working on that stuff.
For sure. Mm. Yeah.
So you're growing up in Kendari, and you, you know, the Western capitalism, Western pop culture is a huge, powerful machine.
Yeah.
How did that come into your life then?
Yeah, well, growing up, because I mean, like I have siblings, but they're all at the time. I think I was in like primary school, junior high, or something like that, and they all went like study abroad, not overseas, but it's just like in a different island.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of like I'm alone all the time at home, like after school. Mm. So I usually I'll pick up like some see like movies and stuff like that. And it's always just like Hollywood movies, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Because we have like Video Easy. Is he?
Yeah.
Stuff like that. So I just like, I grew up watching a lot of Hollywood movies and like listening to like Western songs.
Mm.
Yeah. Mm. I mean, it wasn't that often, but I don't know. I've always just been drawn to like, you know, like Western sort of art and movies. And that's why I think I developed like American accent growing up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which I find, I mean, there's a stronger legacy of that perhaps in the Philippines, which I think is connected to their particular mode of colonization. But it is interesting how it becomes this kind of global accent in a sense.
Mm. Yeah, for sure. And like, I've never even stepped in like the
America. Right. Yeah.
In the US. But yeah, I have. Yeah.
So was American content, would you say that was a big part of your exposure to English language growing up?
Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely.
What was your experience with languages growing up?
I speak in like Bahasa, obviously, but there's also like different dialects and stuff.
Yeah.
So we have our own way to speak Bahasa in Kendari,
okay,
in like Sulawesi in general.
Uh-huh.
And then I moved to Java to do my bachelor's degree.
Right.
And they have different ways to like say, like to say things there as well. They have like different slangs and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And my, like my parents both have their own languages too. So like, cause they're from different, like, Suku. I don't know I'm forgetting the English language for, yeah, so they're from like different, areas.
You can say in
language. Yeah, well, it's called Suku, but I forgot what it is in English, but yeah.
It's fine, English is overrated.
So they also speak different languages, but then they never taught me any of their own languages. So, and obviously English. And then I also studied a little bit of German in high school, which was kind of weird. It was so random. I don't know why German, because,
Yeah. We actually, in primary school, we had some Indonesian learning in our primary school, which for a Western Sydney state primary school, I thought like to be, to not get obsessed with the Latin and European languages, but to be cognizant in the, you know, early 90s of our biggest neighbor.
Yeah, exactly.
Was like a really, really
cool thing.
That's
how it should be. Yeah.
And I enjoyed playing a little bit with language on the streets as I was kind of moving through and just getting that. Because I grew up only with English. My family and parents and culture was colonized to such a degree where we became first English.
First language
in our household in Sri Lanka.
Wow.
And so of course my parents didn't think it anything of value to pass on Sinhala or language to us. So I needed to kind of start from scratch when I went back. But it was I don't know if that perhaps that primary school little exposure did help in a little way, because I was able to like get the basics going and
Wait, so does that mean Bahasa was your second language and then...
No, I wouldn't say so. I would just say like a little bit of primary school exposure.
Yeah.
And then, I was just a mono language person until I moved back to Sri Lanka like 5-6 years ago, and then started from scratch and learnt.
That's crazy.
Tried to start learning language. But in the trip getting there, since it was overland, I was sort of going through multiple countries and like playing with a bit of language on the way, which is, I guess, a kind of helpful learning exercise. Although I think whilst I'll never have the privilege of a white person learning languages that are not theirs, where they get endless encouragement, I guess I did have that non-East Asian appearance when I was in those countries. So I perhaps got an experience of some of that, like some of that kind of like, we don't expect you to speak this language, but you're giving it a go. So like, we're going to give you some enthusiasm. But as soon as I got to Sri Lanka, like nothing. Like, it's like,
what?
Why do you mean you don't speak this? Like,
That's funny. Was that your first time, like, going back as well?
It was my first time going back as an adult and going back solo. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
All previous trip. It had been maybe 10 years since I'd been on a family trip prior.
Yeah.
But we used to, every 3-4 years, we used to do family trips. And, yeah, it was wildly different being outside the family bubble and not having that focus and just being out there on your own and no language and starting with no language and then just, like, incrementally learning it over 4 years or so. Yeah.
That's amazing, though. That must have been so, like, you know, like, connecting and...
It was...
It's like a huge cultural, like, reset.
Yeah, yeah. That would be a great way to describe it. It's very much hard to describe 4 years. And, like, some people go, like, oh, how was it? It's like, oh, it's so many things. It's so layered. But there was a long, slow reward of, like, finally finding, like, the right teacher and the right class and linguist and environment for me to try and learn that, because it was, like, way too abrasive to try and learn on the street with everyone just, like, giving you weird looks. It's like, why are you some this brown dude that can't? What are you, Indian or something?
Yeah.
Like, ah, no. What they think everywhere else in the world. Why do they think that here too? My crowning achievement of that was I was questionably in this role of festival manager of the Women of the World Festival.
Wow.
all the rest of the team were women, and my managers at the British Council would not have. We've been working together for a few years. She's like, no, you're doing the gig. I was like, okay, this feels really strange. But essentially I was production manager, so it wasn't as wide as it sounds. But I was able to, work with a lot of staff and contractors in language. And the sort of crowning achievement moment was being on the phone, so like one degree sort of higher, because you don't have any of the visual. It can be a very expressive visual language, as I'm sure you'd be familiar with as well. But at the front of the venue for the Women of the World Festival was maybe a 3-story high cutout figure of a man that was going to be promoting an upcoming film. And that man was not only a famous actor, but he was a politician and, you know, quite revered and popular and all these sorts of things. And, so my little moment of achievement was to be able to negotiate with his press secretary or manager or something in singular on the phone that, you know, come on, this is a women's festival. Can we just take down this giant cutout of a man just for these couple of days? Is that okay?
Oh my God.
And like, managed to get that one done. So.
Wow. How did they react?
I think I was able to sort of, say, oh, it's a women's festival, and it doesn't look good, and like, you know, like this sort of thing. Like, it's not that we don't like this person. We're not saying we don't. Like, all this sort of reassurance and so like three or four years in, I was able to get to that level, which is still basic, but
that's great. Imagine, because like I mean, you know, you're there to obviously facilitate and empower women, but you know, to a degree, like you don't have to be front and center.
I'm just
thinking about like last weekend with Siki. Like obviously Siki was hosting and it was all his ideas, but he was not like, you know, he's like, he keeps you know, he's humble about it, and like he keeps everyone, like all the girls, like front and center.
Right. And you're like creating space for that sort of transition in a way. And like, I think my role, as awkward as it was, like being in that role, it was also a kind of a sign of the times at that moment that there was such bad gender representation in the events production, events management industry and the scene at the time. I'm pretty sure it has been improving since then. It was a few years ago now, but I guess it's sort of like holding space and supporting something with the understanding that, like, should the right person come along, that you step out of the way
and
help them get through as well.
Yeah, no, that's great. Mm. Yeah, well done.
Is it cool? Have you, I haven't had much to do with the Women of the World Festival here in Australia, because they all come under that same licensing thing that comes from London and South Bank.
Yeah.
Has that crossed your
No, actually,
here?
This is my first time hearing it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, okay. I don't know if they have a a Brisbane arm. But tell me about your experience with busking, because I feel like that is something, like, it's almost like a rite of passage that all musicians should go through, because my experience of it, like, you experience like all levels of engagement from zero to drunk people.
Yes.
And
zero to drunk people.
it feels like it teaches you to perform in like this 360 degree fashion. Like, what's some of your experiences with it?
I bus in the markets,
yeah,
train stations, festivals. Mm. Festivals are always fun, like, and gigs, because, you know, I used to have my little sign and say, like, help me get tickets or something like that. Or like, this is
so
ticket,
you'd be outside busking.
Ticket fun. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. yeah, and it's so fun because 90% of the time I would get free tickets, or I would get like free entry somehow.
Yeah.
So like, this one time I was out listening.
From people seeing you do that.
Yeah.
They would give you.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Because there's always
like a spare
ticket.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, because, you know, I get so much traffic, and, you know, sometimes people are sick or something like that, and they were gonna like give it to a scalper or something like that, and then they saw me and they're like, you know, no, it's like, yeah. So like, most of the time it's like pity, but whatever. Like, I mean, I'm getting it for free.
It's a I guess putting yourself out there
for sure
allows them to feel more comfortable being part of the gift economy or donating something to you.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. And this one time, like, this lady was just offered to buy me a ticket.
That's so nice.
Yeah, this one time, I think it was like Maroon 5. I got given 3 tickets. So I like called my friends and was like,
3,
get your asses.
Value of like,
oh, 170 or something
each.
Like that. Yeah, because it was at Brisbane Entertainment Center. Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Wow. Hot tip, if you can't afford to go to a gig, get outside.
I was thinking about getting back into it, but actually, no, it's fine. Yeah. Everyone can do it. Everyone's welcome.
Yeah. Well, there's 3 tickets, so.
Yeah, exactly. there's enough tickets for everyone.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if you're familiar with Slumberjack. They're like their electronic duo in Australia, but mm-hmm. they did a gig. They did a show at Splendor in the Grass 2015, and they saw. Like this, so I was busking. I was with another like ex at the time,
yeah.
And they just had like guest passes, and they were like, "Oh, no one's like, you know, we didn't bring anyone else, so you can have this." And it was like VIP.
The band themselves, or someone from the band.
The band themselves, yeah. They approached us because they were just like walking with the patrons. I mean, like, yeah, they weren't. I honestly don't know, but I think they were still sort of like not as big at the time.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Nice. What a gesture.
Yeah.
So nice.
Yeah. But yeah, like in terms of, you know, people, I get all kinds of people and, you know, insults.
Yeah.
Like.
Yeah.
A lot, like most of it are like, you know, praises or just like people just like glare at you, like just look at you and move, like walk along, which is good. But there are like some experiences.
Yeah.
People calling me like, oh, that's, you know, why would you do that?
Yeah.
Like, oh, that's so shit.
Yeah. Do you get this sense where people kind of mistake busking for begging?
Yeah.
Hmm.
I don't know. Yeah. Like, I feel like it's just, people see it as, yeah, I mean, absolutely, yeah, definitely.
Mm.
Sorry, that took me a while. But, yeah, people look down on it so much.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because, yeah. I don't know. It's like I'm offering, you know, music and entertainment, but it's not just.
Yeah. It's a certain level of humility and vulnerability that not a lot of people are willing to.
For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
I have to drag myself into the venue a lot of the times. I mean, markets are great because market people are very welcoming to like bus.
Low barrier to expectations.
Is that, yeah. And because like they're used to it as well. There's like buskers everywhere and markets and like, I guess, train stations too. Train stations can be like, yeah, dreadful as well because everyone's just like trying to get on with their day, just want to go home or like go to the office.
Yeah.
And people are usually stingy.
Yeah.
festivals and gigs, though, like the people barely see like buskers there. So I do get like, I don't know.
It's, oh, and they're congregating around a music event.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And so sometimes they either like compare you to like the music that they've just seen or like they want to see, or like, it's just like, it's they're just not used to it. And they're like, what are you doing here? Mm. Yeah. But other people were like, oh, you should be on stage.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is great.
Nice, nice.
Yeah.
Have festival gigs come your way so far?
I have performed at festivals, but with my band actually called BBTK. Are you familiar with BBTK?
I have had like, so from afar, like I'm quite inclined to a bit of grime, and from afar I kind of got to know about Nerve and his music.
Yeah.
And I would DJ some of his tunes in Sri Lanka.
Amazing.
And then I was living in the Sunny Coast before I moved to town.
Yeah.
And I saw that he had a gig pop up, and it was at Backtalk Arts. And
oh, yes.
It was some time ago now. It was before I moved to town. Maybe
2021.
Year and a half. Yeah. 2 years ago. Yeah. And that was such a lovely taste of the Mianjin scene and the sort of like real DIY elements, both in the venue, Backdock Arts, being like super lovely and like rough around the edges, but also like this community around No One Network.
Yeah.
And
oh yeah, they have cult following.
Right.
It's crazy.
Yeah. Tell me, because you were not only performing at that event as part of BBTK, but you've also like produced tunes with that. Like, tell me about that connection and how that started.
Yeah. Well, I think it started because I used to be involved in another collective, bunch of us. We're not a thing anymore, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But I got to meet like this, like just musicians and stuff. Mm. And that's how BBTK was formed initially.
Yeah.
So, and we all decided to apply for Bad Olive, like another festival, like art and music festival. And it was like, it was a lineup of all female. Mm. And that was cool. And it sort of like put us on the map. And that was my first time performing as Hartika as well. So we were all performing individually, but I had a song called Pussy Power that I got the girls to write verses to.
Okay, right.
Yeah, so they all come up for my set. And I think that kind of like, that sort of attracted everyone to us. And then Toby Nerve reached out to one of the girls, Bridget, and was like, do you guys want to, you know, get in the studio sometime and write a song? So I don't know if you've heard it, but we did backing vocals for his track and one of his EP, I think the last EP that he put out.
What was the track called?
Baby Stop Running Your Mouth.
All right.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So that was really fun. And I think from there, we got closer to the No One team, and they started putting us at like on shows and stuff. And so that's how we did like Yonder, and what else, like BSAF, Brisbane Street Art Festival.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can't remember. There's another festival. It's just a doof doof, but yeah, it was really fun. Yeah. We had fun. Rabbits and Lettuce was under a different collective called Freestyle Fridays.
Okay,
but
right.
Yeah, I think after that, like people sort of, we gained some momentum and we were booked on pretty, big ones.
Nice.
Yeah.
Do you remember that Backtalk Art events?
Yeah.
And what was that night like for you?
It was great. And I think that was I remember it being the performance that I'm most comfortable and confident doing. Because obviously, like, I'm always more confident
in the group setting.
Yeah, in the group setting. Like, okay. I'm always more confident with BBTK because, you know, it's just much more fun and relaxing having other people perform with you.
Yeah.
The show was great. Like, obviously, everyone was there for the community, and like No One Network has like a cult following, so it really put us on the map.
Yeah.
And it's just it was just really hype, and I think I remember having lots of fun. Yeah. Those boys, they do a lot for Brisbane scene, obviously.
Mm.
And I guess for me it's just like, you know, it's not really like it's not as aligned to like what I'm trying to do anymore, because obviously there are like hip hop and and it's just like the demographic sometimes it's not really the ones I'm trying to reach. Because, you know, sometimes like after those gigs, I would get like lads and, you know, and following me on Instagram. And I'm like, do you even listen to like this stuff, like the stuff that we make? Like, do you listen to R&B or are you just, you know, you just...
Hip hop adjacent.
Exactly. Mm. Yes.
Mm. Yeah.
So it's really interesting.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Do you find that the kind of community and listeners and supporters of the Shoku Life scene is sort of more aligned with where you're?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Tell me about that one, because I had a really nice first experience in in Vent Space, hanging out for a whole afternoon.
Yeah, just listening
to tunes. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like I'm still a baby producer.
Yeah.
I'm trying to get into production a lot more, and that's, I think that's what the whole community sort of like, what the community is derived off, like producers, and the whole ethos as well, I fully align with. So, because it's all just about like, you know, personal development sort of thing with like, you know, with production and stuff. It's, you know, you show like whips, like work in progress, and you get feedback from the community, from everyone.
Yeah.
And it's all about like learning, like knowledge sharing, that sort of thing. Mm. And it's really good. Like, and it's a great place to find collaborators as well, I found.
Mm.
'Cause obviously everyone's just trying to like come up together, but it's not all about just clout and, you know, trying to network to get to the top sort of thing, because it's basically just like music and communities at the forefront, which is great.
Yeah.
I love that, and I'm trying to be more involved because I love that the potluck, like this, the different events that they put on.
Yeah.
Potlucks, beat sessions, that sort of thing. It gives you a chance to sort of showcase your music and connect. And yeah.
Was it a beat sessions that was happening at Echo and Bounce? Was that the night?
So that was the, it's just like a live music event that they put on for Bruce Asia.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
it was connected to that. Okay, right. And I could only stay for like your first tune on that night, and you were performing in the middle of these two like beautiful, intricate kind of sculpture. Like, can you remember more about them?
They're two like art installations. It's just like a sculpture.
Yeah.
But it's made out of apparently all recycled materials.
Right.
I can't remember the artist.
On that night, did you feel like you had more people with you on stage? Because I saw that first tune, and I think the Bruce Asia part maybe prompted you to lean into more your cultural origins. Can you talk me through that night?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was all me because, like, Shoku obviously asked me to perform for, and it's like Bruce Asia, and I feel like that's just such a good way for me to showcase my heritage, and like, I don't really channel that often, and so I thought it was like a good opportunity for me to actually do my research and, you know, find some different like sounds that I can incorporate, like different samples and stuff, and like you know, learn dances, because like I've always wanted to do that, but I just haven't had the opportunity to.
Yeah.
And it's a good way because I used to perform at Indonesian fairs and stuff.
Okay.
But it's, you know, obviously it's all Indonesian that attends.
Yeah.
So in Bruce Asia, you get like all sorts of, you know, people attending. It's like it's open for public, and it's a good way to show people who hasn't been exposed to Indonesian culture, hey, this is the culture.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And it was, I had lots of fun just prepping for the set, and I feel like that, you know, like I learned a lot from it. And and it was performing at Echo and Bounce as well. It's such a good venue, and everyone was, I mean, I hope everyone was enjoying it.
Yeah. Did you have some reflections from people that night?
Yeah. Everyone was saying they loved it. I mean, like, I thought that wasn't my best. Because, like, I deal with stage fright still.
Yeah. Tell me about that.
Yeah. Well, I've performed, like, hundreds of times.
Yeah.
Between busking
and everything.
Yeah. I performed since, like I was in university and, you know, I'm in my big age of 29. So that was, like, it was a long time. And I've always dealt with public speaking and, you know, interviews and all that sort of thing. And I've definitely improved a lot. But, like, with my stage fright, it's still, like, it comes and goes. And I think it depends on, like, obviously the environment, who was there. Mm. If there were some people that I'm like, oh, intimidating.
Yeah.
Then that could affect my performance. And, like, performing alone too, that's, like, a big factor. Like, if I'm with BBTK, it's like, that's fine. We feed off each other's energy.
Yeah.
That's great. I think that particular gig, I think I sometimes just put too much expectations too. Like, I thought everyone was going to be up and, you know, standing up and, like, crowding in the stage and, like, dancing and stuff. And that wasn't really the case. It was like, it's harder to, like, see people's reactions.
Yeah, you really want to play the crowd. And
yeah, exactly. If they're not moving and then they, because sometimes they just have, like, a, you know, poker face.
Oh, people have crazy faces when they're watching performances.
Yeah. Yeah. And so sometimes that's okay when I'm, like, in. Actually, yeah, it's really weird. Like, because sometimes when I'm in big stage and, like, the lights are all, you know, on me, then I couldn't really see audiences, like, you know, faces. Like,
does that play better for you?
Yeah.
Right. That's really interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, I know.
You hear that from big artists that are used to, like, stadium shows or very big shows, and they kind of get in that sense of security from this sort of, like, anonymous nature of things being blown out by lights.
Absolutely.
And then, do you know SoFar Sounds, those little like lounge room gigs?
Yeah.
I've done a bunch of them, and because I was doing, like, a hip hop comedy thing, they would play really well in those intimate environments. You've got a captive audience. It's almost like that stand up comedy kind of environment. But you would hear things like really seasoned artists being terrified of these intimate environments because you're that connected to your audience, and that can scare some people.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, me all the time. Yeah. So it's just, because I feel like when you know, you remove that factor of, you know, audience.
That separation of, like, stage and audience.
You get, like, you know, you are able to be more focused and more entranced with what you're doing on stage.
Mm.
So, yeah, it's just, it's every gigs aren't the same.
Mm.
So it's like, it's hard to know, really. But, like, at Vent Space, it was actually, I had fun.
Yeah.
I think from early on, I wasn't nervous. I was just, I know, like, I think I'm just getting better at switching that, you know, like, narrative, like, oh, you're not nervous, you're excited. And that's what I try to focus on.
Is that something, like, you're someone who puts out a lot of visual content and a lot of videos of covers and is incredibly productive with your media output.
Yeah.
But in almost all of these, you're surrounded by instruments, you have loopers, you have samplers, you've got lots of things going on. You play multiple instruments, right?
Yeah.
I
dabble.
Haven't seen you on stage too much, but we don't see that many of those things on the set. Is that kind of, are those things tied together? Are you much more comfortable with the camera on at home?
Yeah.
And
definitely.
And does that mean that you, like, is it the instruments and samplers and things, are they just, like, more complicated layers that would increase that stage anxiety? Are those things connected, or, like, is that a conscious decision not to bring the production to the stage?
Yeah, well, I think what you said about, like, that it being, you know, it's gonna increase my anxiety, I feel like that's definitely the case.
Right.
But also it's a separate thing. Mm. So me online doing my Life Loop covers, that's just me doing covers.
Yeah.
And as opposed to being, you know, me live
doing
performing
original,
my own original, because I think that was, I'm more comfortable being a singer-songwriter there, like on stage.
Yeah.
And then when I'm at home. I'm a multi-instrumentalist because I'm just not there yet to like take it outside of my bedroom on stage.
Yeah.
I'm just not that comfortable. And I definitely like, that's definitely my goal. Like I want to definitely have more of a live show and where I'm incorporating like instruments and I'm actually playing live.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what that's going to look like yet. Mm. So I've started using my sampler on stage. So I did that at Echo and Bounce. Like I did a bit of like finger drumming, that sort of thing. So I'm actually practicing.
Fred again, inspiration perhaps.
I don't know how he does it because like I'm getting arthritis because it's just like finger drumming is hard.
I've got a background as a drummer and I don't fully understand it either. Like I don't know how you get that dexterity and sort of independence of fingers. I guess he also has a background being a pianist. So that could be part of, do you?
I did a couple of like lessons when I was like 11, but I think I found it boring and so I stopped.
I mean my mum was a singing and piano teacher and she tried with me a few times, but I was just like also just like had to go and play the drums. So I think I had that same thing.
I know, but I feel like I should have.
Oh yeah, I missed out. I stuck totally to it. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Definitely.
Yeah, but I think like growing up, I do because I'm always just like drawn into music, and like I said, like I'm alone a lot after school. Mm. So I did like eventually just like learn myself.
Yeah.
Same with guitar. My classmate went in high school, like taught me a few chords, and then after that, I just like practiced myself. And same as drumming. Like I haven't had any lessons, but it's, you know, obviously it's just like really basic, like on the drum pads, that sort of thing. Mm. I think if I put in, you know, more hours on it and like get lessons and stuff, obviously I would be a lot more confident with my instrument playing.
Yeah.
But I'm not there yet. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. I see a lot of musicians have different strategies and pick areas that they're going to focus on.
Yeah.
And that kind of thing. But I noticed from your content and the volume of things that you put out, and also from in preparation for sitting down today, checked out your website, that kind of thing. Like you, more than most artists I encounter, tick like every box of like, you've got the EPK sorted, you've got the bio sorted, the press shots are there. The how many remixes do we have of Anesthetic now? How many?
Just the one that I've made or on the
remix? Give me both.
Oh man, like 20, well not 20, probably like 17, like on that sort of 17, 16. Right. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So you're a very... very, I don't know how to say this, like proficient or very accomplished at doing all the music management things that we're told to do as artists.
Thanks.
What drives that?
Yeah.
What do you get out of it?
Yeah.
And then I'll ask you another question.
Yeah, sure. So, what drives that is basically I just want to do it right. So, I think it comes from like me being a perfectionist too.
Right.
And also like all this, because obviously my parents' expectations are for me to stay in a corporate job.
Yeah.
And obviously like climb up the ladder, all that stuff, like, you know.
Right. So is that your present setting for daytime work?
Sorry?
Is that your present lifestyle for
work at the moment? Just quit.
All right.
Yeah, a month ago. So I'm like unemployed right now, but I just went back to Indonesia and I had to like straight up lie and be like, yeah, I'm still working. I'm still working in, you know, my day job.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, I feel like...
I didn't know this.
Yeah, it's... Oh, I talk about all of this in the documentary.
Okay. Because
the struggle of being an Asian kid.
Yeah.
With, you know, parents of high expectations, like with high expectations and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And creative outlets and like creative careers isn't like considered as something to pursue. Mm. And so I've always like, they've always known me as obviously like I love music. My dad like bought me keyboard and guitar when I was little, so like surely they would like what do you expect?
Right.
No, it's not like they think that it should just be a hobby.
Yeah.
Like it shouldn't be a way to make income.
Mm.
And so that's kind of what drives me as well, because like I want to do it right. I want to make sure that I'm successful. I want to be able to show my accomplishments and be like, hey, this is actually the right path for me. Like I'm doing well.
Yeah.
Sorry. I'm doing that again.
You're right.
Tapping. And yeah. And obviously like at the same time, I just want to put my music out and I just want to reach my, target audience. So that's why I'm like, I read the books. I watched the TikTok videos about how to like, start out as a independent artist.
Yeah.
And I figure out the checklist, what I need to do, in terms of branding and marketing.
Yeah.
Like assets wise, yeah. Like what I need to provide, I'd already said marketing, but distribution, like where do I need to go? Cause I just don't want to like anesthetic. Obviously I'm like, I'm done with it now.
Yeah.
I'm so sick of it, but yeah, like I thought it was a great song.
Yeah.
And so I fully believe in it. And I was like, I wanted to, do all I can to make sure it reaches people. But that's where I think I put a lot of expectations. Again, like expectations is just hard. It's healthy to put some expectations, but when you put like metrics on to the performance of what you put out, it's just like that's where it gets you. Because I was definitely, I had to, I went down the hole of like, oh, this is not good enough, like this is not performing the way I wanted to. Yeah, and
it's such a cyclical thing as an artist, right?
Yeah.
You just keep going in that.
Yeah, because like I think my goal was like, oh, I just want it to be over 1,000 plays. I mean, which is, it already is like on Spotify.
Yeah.
But like I shouldn't have to be focusing on that, because like there's obviously other good things that have like come from like me from releasing and putting all that content out there. And so just. Yeah, trying to ignore the numbers and just be like, I put music, this is what I created, and I put it out.
Yeah.
That should just be an accomplishment in and of itself.
To have more focus on just making it good.
Making a good art.
Getting it done.
Yeah, and then just try and connect and engage with the people who listened to it, that liked it, because they are the core people that will support.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So being such a well-self-managed musician, having so many bases covered, like when I asked you for your bio, you could just quickly drop me a link because all that stuff's sorted, which is something that every artist should do.
Yeah.
So that there's the friction point there is zero.
Yeah.
So whenever you don't have to get chased up for a bio, for a photo, all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Which I've been on both sides of that, on the music management side and the artist side. Yeah. So I know all all sides of that. But where are you finding the challenges? What's the friction points for you now?
I think I feel like I burned myself out with the first song, because I was like, I want to do as much as possible.
Yeah.
But now having to redo that to this, my second release, it's like, it's just too much work.
Yeah.
And for little result, which is still, I need to unlearn that sort of mentality that needs to perform well. So, I'm just trying to like take it easy and just be like kind to myself, and obviously still create that strategy, because I can just like reapply what I've already done for anesthetic, but I just need to be a lot more sustainable with it. Yeah. And I think because I was dealing a lot with like self-worth as an artist, because I feel like, I've done all this work and it's not getting enough attention. And I see all this, like, my peers who started, like, just the same time as me or after, who's managed to, you know, peak so fast.
Right.
So much faster than
comparison, me. That comparison,
right? That comparison, absolutely.
Thief of joy.
Yeah, for sure. And it just feels like, you know, I've always had to be, I had to do harder. Like, I had to work harder to yield little results.
Yeah.
I think it's just,
I feel like I've heard you or seen you write that before, like,
yeah,
that sense of working harder. Are you comfortable sharing more light on that?
Yeah. I mean, obviously, like, as I deal, like, there's, like, a lot of factors. I deal with anxiety and, I've just putting myself out there kind of thing sometimes is very scary. And I've gotten used to it now. Like I churn out like content like left, right and center.
Yeah.
And I don't like, I learned to like not give a fuck anymore.
Yeah.
But it's still like, I anxiety is just, you know, it's great. Cause I'm a lot more self-aware. In a sense that, you know, like I try to be kind, I try to be humble, like I don't want to be like, you know, I try to treat people, I try to treat people nicely and I try to support like fellow creators, that sort of thing. But at the same time, obviously I cringe at myself a lot. And oh my God. See, I'm like,
yeah.
Yeah. I'm anxious just talking about being anxious. And at the same time, obviously it holds myself back because I feel like I could have said yes to opportunities. I mean, it's not like I've got a lot of opportunities coming my way.
Yeah.
But I feel like I could have done a lot more maybe because I'm just like too scared. At the same time, obviously the family expectations factors.
Yeah.
And
what's that like for you? Cause you're geographically quite separated. You've just spent some time back there.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I don't know. I think there's just a certain image that I need to uphold and like when I'm with them. And obviously like I have a lot more freedom being here because like I'm a lone wolf, like none of my family's here, so I can do whatever the fuck I want. But online, obviously I need to be, you know, I need to be modest because like my family's Muslim.
Okay.
And so they want, you know, I have to hold myself back and like I can't be too sexy, that sort of thing, which is I don't want to do anyway.
Yeah.
But
so you feel that tone policing from Indonesia socials or fire. Yeah,
because I have nieces and nephews too, and I don't want them to find my content and be like,
right. Oh, so that, yeah, because I was wondering, like, would elders and older family members be the one that would be on these platforms? But that's what you're thinking of.
Yeah, my nieces and nephews, because I feel like my brothers and my parents don't really like, I don't think their algorithm would like send me to them.
Yeah.
But obviously it's different with like the nieces and nephews, and I just want to be like a good influence for them. But obviously, yeah, at the same time I want to be successful enough that I can show them that, you know, I can take this path and be successful, and you know, they don't have to like, I don't have to conform to like what they want me to be.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Other than that, I think, yeah, I think just, you know, how it is in Australia and like in the industry as well, I feel like it's so much harder as, you know, like artists of, you know, women of color, to thrive.
Yeah.
'Cause like you see like, you know, festival lineups and stuff like that, and other sort of initiatives like for like independent or like, you know, musicians, where it's still sort of predominantly like white artists.
Yeah.
I mean, like, I don't honestly, like, before the documentary, I tried so hard to not be like political about everything because I'm like, I just don't want to offend anyone. But it's just also at the same time, this is my experience, so it's just like it's hard to just keep it in for myself anymore because I've had like, you know, like peers who are like white, like as I mentioned, that have, you know, had Triple J plays on the, like,
yeah,
the first song. I mean, like, I've had it, but I've been played at Triple J, but that was like, because I'm a queer artist. Mm. So it was like, I still have to be boxed in somehow. Yeah. So it's like all the gigs that I've played, it's like, it's either like for, you know, Asian artists, like showcasing Asian artists, which is the
like BrizAsia.
BrizAsia, yeah. The Wild Jasmine show, and then the Brisbane Pride Festival as well.
Yeah.
So it's all like I don't really exist outside of that, outside of the and like it's hard to not take it the wrong way, because like I'm like, it's either that or I'm just looking down at myself being like, am I not talented enough, am I not confident enough, am I not like attractive enough, or like is my music not as good, yeah, that like
the,
sort of
the
thing.
Western beauty lens is
strong. Am I not palatable enough, that sort of thing. So it's either I put myself down for my own talent, which is, I don't think is right, because I am like, I know I'm talented. I know I'm just as good, if not more.
Yeah.
Or, you know, like I just, admit that it's just the system that's like not accommodating to me.
Is that, you mentioned like cringing at your own stuff. Is there also like a part of you that's kind of like can look back and go like, oh, look, like progress, that sort of thing?
Oh, absolutely. Right. All the time. Yeah, it's great. And yeah, obviously, like I went from just like my like bedroom studio, which is not like, I was on the floor. I had like, you know, very little instruments, that sort of thing. And I was just with my acoustic guitar, which was like not even good quality. And then, and then I did that just like, because like at that point I was just like, I was just creating for the sake of creating. I looked at it as like, this is just me practicing music, but I record myself and I put it out so I can look at it later or something like that. And obviously that sort of like exponentially sort of grow.
Was this more the YouTube cover
days?
Right.
Yeah. Okay. And so like now I do like Life Loop covers, and even like lately it's a lot better than what I was before.
Yeah.
And obviously like, yeah, I cringe at the old videos because it's like, oh my god, this is not like, you know, up to standard at all. But at the same time I'm patting myself in the back so for having come so far.
So there's definitely like, yeah, being a solo performer is a lot to carry on your shoulder, and you have to deal with all the, particularly as a, I guess, an empathic artist, and dealing with the sensitivities of different audience and feeling that sense in the room.
Yeah.
When I hung up my music hat, I really noticed my entire online interaction had shifted. It's like I could take off this armor of like constant comparison. Like anytime I saw someone doing gigs here, doing gigs there, there was like, yay, a bit of joy for them, but also like instantly that comparison. It's like I didn't realize that until I'd taken off that hat and off the armor and off the hustle. But yeah, amidst those great challenges of art and creating, there's also, as you mentioned with Choku Life and other spaces, there's this sense of community. And I do see you making these like lovely posts of these like picnic park jams.
Yes.
Can you tell me about those and like, what happens there?
Okay. Well, yeah. I totally agree with like, you know, the importance of community, just being a solo artist, especially like you want to have that support network. Cause it's not great like going up together. I mean, going up alone and not having like anyone to sort of bounce off, you know, how you're feeling, that sort of thing. And, park jams is just like a way for me to create my own community. Cause like that, I want that to be like a way for me to network with other musicians, obviously, and also a good way for me to practice my instrumentation and jamming with other people. And it's just, it's just a great way to connect and just relax after a long week, and just because it's just, Yeah, like music, at you know, music's just, music's such a therapeutic like method for, yeah. So
just dealing with everything, dealing with life, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I always feel so full after those jams and, it put me through to like so many like amazing, talented musicians in Mianjin because everyone likes jamming. And I got to know like some people on like a deeper level, which is great.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, we're going to have to tune into the documentary to get the full deep dive on your transition from corporate to artist life and some of those things that you're juggling with there. But I want to thank you so much for coming on today.
Thank you. Cheers. Thanks for having me.